Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to The Untold Story, everybody. I'm Martha McCallum. Great to have you with us today. And I'm very pleased to be joined by Jim Wahlberg, who is an author, a producer. His book is called The Big Hustle, A Boston Street Kid's Story of Addiction and Redemption. It is a beautiful story that we're going to get into a bit today. He's also the producer of the film Mother Teresa, No Greater Love, that came out in 2022. So, Jim, welcome. Great to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here.
Well, you know, I saw you on with Laura Ingraham, and then my family and I are doing Pray 40 on Hallow, which is a daily Lent meditation, and it's incredible, and you're involved in it. Your brother Mark's involved in it. Jonathan Rumi, who I've interviewed several times and gotten to know a little bit. So the other day was your day, and you gave your story of surrender and how you surrendered to God. And my son, who's 23 years old, texted me, "Wow, did you guys listen to this yet?" And So we all actually, you know, listened to it throughout the day and were chiming in on it. So maybe, I'm sure a lot of people didn't hear it. So maybe you could just start by telling us, obviously you're part of the amazingly talented Wahlberg family, so creative and do so much to sort of contribute to our culture. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Jim.
Well, let's see. I'm one of nine children. I'm the middle child of nine. I think that matters somehow in the big picture. I think I have the middle child syndrome, whatever that really means. My life was really colorful, you know. From as young as I can remember, I just always seemed to be into something, and the something I was always into was never anything good, you know. I was drawn to trouble. And it's really hard to explain. I feel like in hindsight, I see it as just, you know, I was desperate for attention. But I was always into something. There was always someone knocking on my door, talking to my parents about something that I took, broke, or did that I wasn't supposed to. And so, you know, simultaneously, you know, you talk about Hallow and you talk about my family, and I think there's sort of a misconception or misinformation, if you will, in the world about us being growing up as this great Catholic family, right? You know, that's, I'm not sure how much further from the truth that can be, right?
I love that.
I don't ever remember going to mass with my parents.
Yeah,
not one time. I think when I made my first Holy Communion, I know my mom was there, and I'm 100% sure, or at least 90% sure, my dad wasn't there. But other than that, we never went to Mass together as a family. We, on Sundays, everybody that was old enough got sent out the door and sent to St. Gregory's, which is about a mile and a half from our house. And so it was usually about six of us were old enough. And we walked out the door, we went in six different directions. We all ended up in the same place, and it wasn't St. Gregory. We all ended up at Walsh Park watching the cops play softball. But we all made our pit stop to get our bulletin, our proof that we went to Mass. Been. Yeah, and I wasn't really raised in the faith as much as I was raised in tradition. Mm-hmm. The tradition of Boston, the tradition of our neighborhood. And I was raised to fear God, not that God loved me, right? Which is a terrible thing to do to a child. Mm-hmm. And so as my life was, you know, constantly, I was constantly finding myself in trouble, and I knew that God knew everything, right? So he has all these additional things for him to be mad at me for, right? And so, you know, by the time I was 8 years old, I picked up my first drink. It was all the kids in the neighborhood thought it would be funny to watch the little kid drink. I drank. I don't think I became addicted in that moment. But I may have become strongly attracted to the attention that I was receiving. You know, I was funny. I was cool. I fit in. I was with the older crowd. And, you know, that meant a lot to me because, you know, strangely enough, growing up with eight brothers and sisters in tight, tight quarters, it was amazing how alone I felt all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't feel a strong sense of belonging, if you will. If that makes sense.
Yep.
So, you know, I was, there's a thing I like to say, I was looking for love in all the wrong places, as the song goes.
Yeah.
I was looking for that love in the streets. I was in, you know, the people in the streets, the kids who were like me, or I like to refer to them as the other broken toys. They were welcoming. They were welcoming to me because I was like them and I was willing to do the things that would make me stand out. And, you know, was always trying to do, we were always trying to one up each other with whatever crazy thing we could do next. And, you know, simultaneously, I'm enrolled in the Boston public school system during the forced integration of Boston, the school system, and going to a different school every year. Every year I went to a different school. I went to seven different schools from first grade to seventh grade.
Wow.
And seventh grade was the final year. I did not go back to school after that. I ended up in an alternative school where they actually paid me $8 a week to show up. And there was not a lot of learning going on. It was really, you know, it was really more like a prison preparatory school, I think. You know, it was full of broken toys. It was full of kids who were doing drugs, drinking, stealing, robbing, and they were always very happy to sort of teach you their newest trick, if you will. And so, you know, I just kind of continued to slide down that rabbit hole. By the time I finished the seventh grade, I remember it was the first night of summer. School ended that day. That night I was sitting at my dinner table. All nine of us are there, or 11 of us. My parents were there, and dinner was at 5 o'clock. And if you weren't home for dinner, you didn't get dinner. And we were sitting there eating dinner, and my mind was in the street. All the fun I was going to have. I was going to be out there with all my friends, my buddies. We were going to be drinking. 12 years old.
Yeah.
And I ate my dinner as quickly as possible. I started heading for the back door. And my dad stopped me and reminded me. He said, "Now, you remember, boy, when those streetlights come on, you better be home. And if you're not going to be here, don't bother coming home." And it seems harsh, but by the time I was 12, by the time I completed the seventh grade, I had already been arrested. I had already run away at least a couple of times. I had already been, you know, intimately involved with the juvenile court system. And so this, it seemed harsh and it sounds harsh. And, you know, as a dad now, I guess it is harsh, but I assured him, no, Dad, when the streetlights come on, I'll be in the house. Don't you worry about a thing. And out I went, and man, I remember it like it was yesterday, just being there behind the lean school in Dorchester with all my friends. The music's playing, we're drinking beers and smoking Newports. And I remember looking up and seeing the streetlights start to flicker. And I looked at the beer in my hand and the cigarette in the other. And I looked at my friends and I heard the music and I saw the girls and I was like, I'm not going to make it. Mm-mm. And that day I made a conscious decision. I chose that life and those people and that drink over the love of my mother and my father and my eight brothers and sisters and my dog Scooter. Right. And there I stayed. And that was like June, probably 22nd ish. And I didn't go home again until the end of August.
Did they look for you? Did they, you know,
So it's a funny thing. So I would see my siblings because I never was more than a couple of miles away from home, right? Mm-hmm. Right down the street, hanging on the street corner where they hung on. Mm-hmm. Did they look for me? I think that my siblings would see me and we would talk, and I knew there was a lot of shame and embarrassment because if you can imagine now, a lot of this time I'm sleeping outside. I'm not mm-hmm. like, sometimes my friends would take me home. Sometimes there was a place for me to sleep, but many times there was not. So, you know, they're aware of my terrible reputation. They're aware of the fact that people are talking about the fact that I'm sleeping outside, you know, and so I'm bringing shame to them. Right. It's hard enough being a kid. Right. And what all that entails. And they were all sort of on their own little paths, and many of their paths, although were never as difficult, I think, as my path in terms of consequences, they all had difficult paths themselves. And so adding on to that, the shame and embarrassment of having a brother who's, you know, homeless in the neighborhood it's a lot. And so, I mean, there were times, like, I knew my parents' schedule. My dad woke up super early. He delivered school lunches. He was a Teamster. And my mom worked overnight. And there were times that I would be out at night, and I hung at the train station that she took the train to go to work. And there were times that I would see her, and she wouldn't see me, and I would just sort of be in the shadows looking at her. And wanting to call out to her, wanting to say, "Mom, I'm here. I love you. Help me." But not knowing what kind of help, I didn't know what kind of help I needed. I just thought I was a crazy person, you know? I never sort of connected the dots in terms of, you know, for me, I don't know what came first. Was it the chicken or the egg? Did I become addicted first and then the difficulties, or did the difficulties happen and was I medicating myself with this alcohol and drugs, and this, you know, this need to fit in somewhere, if you will?
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine how, I mean, your mom had so much on her plate. She had 9 children and she's working overnight, and, you know, it's easy to look at this from a, you know, sort of comfortable, smaller family perspective of like, why didn't everyone jump in? Why didn't your mom just run over and tell you she loved you? And, but you know, the struggles that everybody was going through, is a reality that I think a lot of families across the country have dealt with, whether it's, you know, relatives who kind of fall off the radar, and it becomes really, as you say, there was some element of embarrassment, some element of, I got my own stuff to worry about and all of this. Mm-hmm. And then, so you end up 12 years old. You were in foster homes at that point occasionally as well?
Yeah. So as part of, becoming a ward of the state at 12 years old. Mm-hmm. So when I say I went home in August, it was home and then right to, you know, the family court and to becoming a ward of the state. And so my life then became a series of, there were occasional times when I would come home to live. They would never last very long, or I would be in juvenile detention, group homes, foster homes, halfway houses. Like, there were times when I was in juvenile detention. I remember one time my caseworker, who's actually still a friend of mine after all these years, his daughter actually works for a company that I own. It's so funny how life works. But he picked me up one time from a locked facility and drove me to a foster home. I might have been in Arlington in Massachusetts, and He dropped me off. I went in the front door and out the back door and was back in Boston before he was.
Wow.
You know, and then there were times that, you know, there were good people that really just opened their homes to me and tried to care for me. There was a family in Brockton that I lived with, and it was a mom and dad. They had two sons, and me and another kid were both living there, and we were both juvenile delinquents, and we were both sent to foster care from the juvenile detention system. And these two brothers, that they're actual kids, looked up to us so much. And I, it was the only time I really had this deep sense of guilt was many years later, I was in prison and a guy walked up to me and he said, "Hey, do you remember me? I used to be your brother." And it was one of their kids.
In prison.
And he, in prison, he followed us right down the path. And I felt so terrible. This was after, you know, a lot had transpired in my life and I was on a road to, you know, getting my life together and having a profound experience with God. But I felt terrible. I felt very, very guilty and very responsible.
The Untold Story continues right after this.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
So let's talk a little bit about prison, and you were in for two different stints. And was it on the second time? It was on the second time, I believe, that you were sort of pretending like you were getting your act together and participating in every form of counseling and trying to convince them that you're on the road to recovering and changing your life. When you have a meeting where a priest approaches you, tell us about that, Jim.
So I'm literally running game, right? I'm doing 6 to 9 years. And the only thing I know is I cannot do 9 years. That's all right. So I got arrested that particular time for robbing a Boston police officer's home. He came home in the middle of the night and found me passed out at his kitchen table. Yes, you're very quiet, Martha.
Mm-hmm.
You're taking that one in, yes.
Yeah.
It was, so I was in a full blackout, that was a common sort of state for me. And I was wandering through South Boston and I was checking car doors and house doors, apartment doors, as I was walking by through this neighborhood. And one of the doors, I turned the doorknob and the door opened. And I walked in, and in this blackout, I maybe just kind of forgot where I was or what was going on, but I collected some of this person's belongings and put it by the door. And then it occurred to me, maybe there's a beer in the fridge. I opened the fridge. There was a beer, and I opened it and sat down at the kitchen table, and I may have dozed off. Now, There's a very important piece to this story that I have to tell that connects to that. Earlier that day, I had made a decision that I was going to switch seats on the Titanic. Okay, so I am a guest on the Titanic, and this ship is going to the bottom of the ocean without a doubt. I was running around with a guy who was shooting 10 bags of heroin in the morning every day to get regular, just so he wouldn't be sick. And somehow his seat looked like a better seat than my seat. And that day I made a conscious decision that I was going to get in that seat next to him. I was going to start shooting heroin. And that night I got arrested. And that night, I believe, is when God intervened in my life. And because I don't think I would be here today if I would have switched seats on the Titanic and sat next to that guy and did what he was doing. He's not here today, I can tell you that. Mm-hmm. But I get arrested after I did 5 years. I was out 6 months of the day and I get arrested again for this breaking and entering. I wake up in the police station and I'm covered with blood and I have no idea why I'm there. I come to find out why I was there. And I remember when I went to court, the district attorney was speaking to the judge and talking about my criminal record and how I had committed this house invasion and that I needed to get a life sentence. And it was the police officer who found me in his house that actually spoke up for me. He said, life sentence? Look at the kid. He's a mess. Why don't you get him some help? And so ultimately, I plead guilty to 6 to 9 years. I go back to prison. And as I said, the only thing I knew is I couldn't do 9 years, because if I did 9 years, I'd be older than 30 when I get out. And that's prehistoric. And so I started to do these things. I started to try to create an illusion that I was becoming rehabilitated. So I started going to 12-step meetings, therapy, counseling, anything I could go. Then I didn't just go to them. I started to run them. I was in charge. I would set up the meeting. I would make the coffee. I would sign the papers that you came to the meeting. And, you know, just trying to create this illusion. And apparently it worked for one person. The Catholic priest, Father James Freitas, approached me at MCI Concord up on Route 2 in Massachusetts. And he said to me, hey, you're Jim Wahlberg. I hear good things about you. I hear you really, really trying to get your life together. And I was like, yeah, that's me, Father. And he said, I have a job opening in the chapel. Would you be interested in being the custodian? And I said, absolutely. Now, I wasn't thinking about going back to Mass, getting to the foot of the cross, going to confession. I was thinking about, he smoked cigarettes, so I was going to get cigarettes. He had a phone in there, so I was going to get access to a phone. He had coffee in there. There was peace and quiet in there, which really doesn't exist in prison. And so I immediately started thinking about all the ways I was going to manipulate the situation, because that's the way my mind worked, right? I have an old saying, I'm not much, but I'm all I seem to think about sometimes. And so I'm trying to hustle this guy. And probably a week or two after I started working in the chapel, I said to him, Father, hey, listen, my brother is in some singing group and apparently they're selling his cassette tapes at Tower Records. Is there any way that you could bring me a cassette tape? I really want to be supportive of my brother. And he said, yes, without hesitation. And the next day, Father James Freitas broke the law and he smuggled in a cassette tape to me and he brought in a cassette player and he let me listen to the music. And you would think, oh, I was so grateful. But actually, I just immediately thought, what was the next thing I was going to have him smuggle? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he said to me, you know, I'm not that great with times. It was probably a week or two later. He said to me, listen, I really need this chapel clean for Mass a Sunday morning. So why don't you come to the vigil Mass on Saturday night? Because everything in prison moves simultaneously. Everybody's cell door opens at the same time. It's open for a period of time and it closes. They're called movement times. So he said, come at that movement time. You can, you know, you hang around and then you can clean the chapel after the vigil Mass. And I never saw the maneuver that he was pulling on me. I never saw that he was hustling me to get me back to Mass. And so I was back to Mass, I was in church, and those old feelings came back. They flooded me, that I didn't belong there, that I wasn't good enough, that I was a sinner, that, you know, all the negative thoughts. And besides, I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know when to stand. I didn't know when to kneel. I didn't know the responses. I sat on Saturday nights next to a guy from Charlestown, Massachusetts, who was a very dangerous professional criminal. And he came from a long line of professional criminals. And he was Catholic. And his, you know, his criminal life was his career choice. That's the way he looked at it. It wasn't, he didn't mean he couldn't be a good Catholic, right? And so he went to Mass every week, and he knew the prayers, and he knew the responses, and went to stand and went to kneel. And I just did what he did. And it, I would say a couple of weeks after being back in Mass and being totally confused and not really know what's going on, Father Freitas came to me excited, and he said, "Listen, we have a special guest coming to this prison." And he was so excited. And I said, "Really, Father, who's coming?" And he said, "Mother Teresa is coming to this prison." And I said, "Wow, that's amazing. Who's Mother Teresa?" Because I didn't know. And I probably didn't know who the president was either at that time, because I was just really damaged. And I remember calling home. I called my mom, and her mom lived in our house for most of our lives. And growing up, all nine of us, and having her there, it was funny because it was like only one of us mattered to her. The other eight didn't really exist too much. my little sister was the princess. She, my grandmother loved her, and the rest of us, she didn't really care about too much. Yeah, exactly. And so my sister got to hang down in her basement apartment and sit in the comfortable recliner chair and eat her Entenmann's while we were all upstairs, you know, eating mayonnaise sandwiches. So my mother, I said to my mother, "Mom, Mother Teresa's coming to this prison." And she repeated it out loud to her mother. And it was the first time I had ever said anything that excited this woman. She was like, "What? Get me a rosary, you know, like, get me something. This is incredible. I can't believe this." And that was really how I first understood the significance of this event and how big of a deal it was, right? So I did a little research, and, you know, I guess I understood that she was an important person, but I didn't have any concept of holiness. I didn't have any concept of potential sainthood. I didn't have any concept of the way she served humanity. I wasn't able to really grasp any of that. And the day came, and I was walking through the quad of this prison. You know, this prison from the inside almost looked like a college campus, except for the, you know, the big 40-foot walls and the razor wire. It kind of, you know, it was set up like a quad. And I was walking, and I looked, and the front door opened, and a bunch of people came through the front door, and they were important people. They were wearing suits. You know, I could see, I started to recognize, I think one of them may have been the governor. The warden was definitely there. There were other prison officials. And as they got a little closer, the group sort of separated a little bit, and there she was. And there were things I noticed about her as she approached me. And as I'm sitting here, I'm looking at a photo on my wall of her feet and her toes all crunched up in little balls in her sandals. And I remember looking at her feet and thinking that her sandals looked like they were 200 years old. And as I came up, her sweater had moth holes in it, and it looked like it was old and raggedy. And I looked, and she had pockets in her sweater, and it was money sticking out of her pockets. And I must confess that I spent a little longer than I should have looking at the money.
Wondering if maybe.
It was confusing. It was confusing, yeah. Because there was no money in prison.
Right.
You know, people, as I know now, people would hand Mother money because they knew what she would do with it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I ran back to the chapel to tell Father Freitas that she was here. And he was like, "Hey, I got more news for you. You're going to be part of the procession because you work here in the chapel. You're going to be part of the procession." And I said, "That's great, Father. What's a procession?" And he said, you're going to walk in with us, with her, with the cardinal, with all." And so that's exactly what happened. And I remember as we processed in, we were in the gymnasium, and the altar was on the stage in the gym. And I remember seeing a big fancy chair, and I remember the cardinal had a big fancy hat on and a big stick. And there was a chair there for mother as well. And as he went up onto the altar, he beckoned her to come and to sit. And she humbly refused. And she put her hands in a praying motion on her forehead as she did. And she just kind of backed up and knelt on the floor with the inmates. And this was very confusing to me, because this was, you know, this was her moment. This whole thing was about her, at least in my mind, right? I know today that in her mind, it was not, none of it was about her. It was all about Jesus, right? But for the rest of us, it was, this is, she's this very important person, and this is her moment to shine. And instead, she chooses to kneel with the inmates. And when her time did come to go up onto the altar, you know, the words that she said changed my life. They're words that I never heard before. Nobody ever told me that Jesus Christ died for me. I never heard that before, right? Nobody told me you are a child of God, that God loves you in spite of the crimes that you've committed, right? And in the sins that you've committed, that God loves you. And this was very, very confusing for me. And, you know, the rest of the day was just kind of a haze. I remember going back to my cell and not sleeping very much, and being confused and tossing and turning. And I remember when that cell opened, I ran back to that chapel to Father Freitas, and I said, Father, I need to know more about this God that she's talking about, not the God that I grew up with. And to his credit, you know, I look back, and in my mind, you know, the memory is a funny thing. You know, I think that I remember the way it was, but it was almost like he chuckled and checked off a little check mark and was like, got one.
Done.
Right? Like he you know, that you mentioned the title of my book, The Big Hustle, right?
Yeah.
And it I think when you read the title, you think, I'm the hustler, right? But no, Father Freitas was the hustler. Father Freitas, working for God, had a singular job, and that was to get me to the foot of the cross. And he did just that. And he did it in such a loving, gentle way. You know, he immediately started to prepare me to make my confirmation, which I had never done as a child. And he didn't open up the catechism of the Catholic Church. He didn't pull out a book. He didn't blow dust off a book and say, okay, here, we're going to learn our faith. He just lovingly taught me our faith in a very simple, kind and gentle way, because I think if he would have handed me a book, I probably would have left the room. I'm not sure I could even read at that point in my life. I was damaged goods. And he gently started to prepare me. And after about 6 months, I remember getting word that I was being transferred, and I ran over to the chapel to tell him. And he said, sit down. And he said, he wanted to know where I was going. And he picked the phone and he called the priest in that prison. And he said, I have a special delivery FedEx package coming to you. His name is Jim Wahlberg, and this is where we are in the process. And he passed me off to the next priest. And that priest passed me off to the next priest as I went to minimum security. And, you know, these things, me going to being transferred to these other prisons was also proof, tangible proof, that being sober and trying to live a godly life had, these were rewards of that. Because my prior sentence, I had a 3 to 5 year sentence. I could have been out in 2 years. But I chose to do all 5 years because of my behavior, because of my need to try to impress other people. I did more time in the hole than I needed to do on the whole sentence. And so that was the way I did time. And now here I am, I'm having this experience because I've had this profound redemptive experience. And I'm working a program of recovery, and things are happening. My life is getting better. Ultimately, I ended up in a minimum security in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And the priest there said, it's time. You're ready to be confirmed into the church. And he said, not only are we going to have a confirmation ceremony here, but you're also going to have a little, you can have a little party. Your friends, your other, some of your friends, inmates, your family can come. And I was like, wow, that's incredible. And I remember calling my mom and saying, Mom, I'm going to make my confirmation. And I really like it if you could be there. And she had to think about it. She said, I don't know. She had made a commitment to herself many years before. She visited me in Walpole State Prison in the hole. And I was unrecognizable as her child. I was a complete animal after spending almost 3 years in the hole. And it crushed her. Yeah. And so she committed to herself and to God that she would never visit another one of her children in prison. And here I am asking her to come and witness me being confirmed into the church in prison. Ultimately, she said yes. You know, and it was a, there was some reluctance there. She showed up. She came with my older sister. And, you know, it's incredible that I would never really know until many years later just how important that day was. Not just because I made the choice to be confirmed into the church, right? But it was such an important moment, day, event in the life, in the relationship between me and my mother. She would refer back to that day for the rest of her life. She would say, at certain moments, occasions, events, family events, weddings, birth of children, she would say, Jimmy, do you remember the day I knew you were different? Do you remember the day when I knew you were going to be okay? And it was that day. That was the day she watched me in that room, in that party afterwards. And she noticed that my head was held high, that I was looking people in the eye, that had true joy, that I never had joy. I was never a happy kid. So she could see the difference. She could see the healing. I didn't. I was probably still thinking, you know, maybe I can steal some of this cake and take it back to myself, right? Like, I don't know where I was really, because I always had doubts. I always had reservations. Because, you know, the truth of the matter is, I remember going to 12-step meetings in prison before my conversion, and thinking, what an amazing thing this program is for them, but it's never going to work for me because I'm not worthy. That's the true sense of who I was as a human being. I didn't feel worthy of anything good. And here I am now having this profound conversion experience and deciding that I want to live out my faith and that I want to try to do this the right way, just one time. And I knew if I failed, that was it. It was over. There was no returning from failure this time.
And when you left prison, there was sort of a hearing, and there was a letter. Tell everyone about that, Jim.
Yeah. So you know, the parole board, I saw the parole board. I was all the way down to pre-release in Framingham, Massachusetts. And I went to the parole board and, you know, you walk into a little room and there's three people sitting on one side of the table. You're sitting on the other and they have your file in sitting on the table. That's all the evidence that they have there. And my file was extensive, to say the least. And I remember going in and saying, you know, easy does it, keep it simple. I'm all better now. You can let me go. And I remember the parole board commissioner laughing. Yeah, whatever. Guess what? You haven't gotten any trouble since you've been here this time, so we're going to let you go, but we'll see you when you get back. Seems like a rotten thing to say, but in that moment, I thought I'd probably see another parole board in my life. And then he said, oh, and with this one letter, someone wrote a letter, right, for you. And so he opened up the letter and it was a letter from my mother. And it said, and I'm paraphrasing, it said, you know, before you stands a man of God, it's okay. You can let him go now. You won't be seeing him again. And to put that letter in context of who my mother was as a woman, one of my brothers got arrested. Him and a bunch of his friends got in a fight and they all got arrested. And it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. And so the next day they're all in court and they're all lined up in front of the judge, and behind them, their mothers standing there. And the judge started with the first guy and he said to the mother, "Tell me about your boy." And each one of them, "Oh, he's a wonderful child. This is an isolated incident. He helps old ladies cross the street. He's a great boy. He does his homework. He does his chores." They got to my mother and my mother said, "Your Honor, lock him up. I haven't seen him in 2 weeks. He's trouble, right? And he's going to get hurt out there in the streets, or he's going to hurt somebody." Mm-hmm. And that's who she was. Mm-hmm. She would not lie for her children. Mm. She would not lie for her children. And so for her to write that letter, I knew what that meant to her, to take the time to do that. And I knew that she believed that.
Yeah.
When she put those words on that paper, she believed what she was writing. And, you know, my life was not without some difficulties along the way, because we all have difficulties, right? But gratefully, I never found the need to pick up a drink or a drug again. It's been 35 years, a day at a time. There were times when I struggle with my faith. There was a period of time where I walked away from my faith. There was a lot going on in the church. It was a huge scandal. And, you know, and I had people around me that were just, you know, in my ear. And I think they were really trying to help me. And I think they believed what they were saying to me, which was, you don't have to believe in the God of your childhood. You can create your own conception of God, which, I'm sorry, Martha, but I just told you for 20 minutes what a scoundrel I was. Now you want to leave it up to me to create my own conception of God. He's going to be a pool hustler. He's not going to be.
He's going to let me do whatever I want.
Almighty. Confession is no, I will not need confession anymore moving forward.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, I slowly started to slip back into this emptiness, right? So outwardly, people thought I was doing fantastic. What happened was I was back to being more concerned about what you thought of me than what I thought of me, right? And what I thought of me was not good. And what I thought about God was not good. I put God into a human form and I created this concept in my mind that God was angry with me. He was resentful at me for walking away from him, right? After I had this profound experience, how could I walk away? Now I'm really guilty, because before it was somebody else's fault. It wasn't my fault, because they all contaminated God for me. But now I had this profound experience and I chose to walk away from him. And so the emptiness crept back in, and I spent all my time looking good on the outside. I spent all my time, you know, building a life, got married, have 3 beautiful children who have never seen me drink, but they have seen me unhappy. They have seen me drop them off for church and drive away with their mom. They have seen me angry. They have seen me, you know, not living a godly life. And so, you know, we moved to Florida after a while. My wife said to me, "We're moving to Florida. You can come with us if you want." That was my invitation. And I said, "Yeah, I guess I better go with my wife and 3 children." And I moved to Florida and I basically just recreated myself. People didn't know me. Everybody in Boston knew me as, you know, yeah, a guy that was getting his life together, but a guy that was homeless, that was a criminal, that maybe robbed someone of their friends' houses, or like those were the kind of interactions I was having on a daily basis. And now I moved into a new state, new neighborhood, new place. Nobody knew me. And so I could recreate myself. And basically what I recreated was the unhappiness that I had felt as a child. And my wife was, you know, she was going to church and she was taking the kids, but I'm not sure that she was, I think it was out of duty. I'm not sure she was having a real spiritual experience at this time. But she went on a retreat and had a conversion of epic proportions and came home. And instead of coming home and doing what my wife would do, if she found something that excited her, it was only going to be a matter of time before it would have to excite me too, or we were going to have a problem, right? So she comes back from this retreat, and she is she's kinder, more gentle, more patient, more tolerant, more forgiving, right? All very attractive. And after a period of time, she started suggesting, maybe you might want to try a retreat. Hey, there's a men's retreat coming up next week, next month. And I would say, no, I'm good. And her and her best friend, who is a woman who is really like my sister, she was also working on her husband at the same time. And he and I got together. We knew that they were conspiring to get us to a retreat. And we got together and we said, nobody breaks the line. You ain't going, I ain't going, that's it.
Right.
Right. And then my wife sent the secret weapon to talk to me. My 12-year-old daughter, Kyra, came to me. And she said, Daddy, I want you to go on this retreat. I want you to be happy. I want you to know Jesus. And I just was crushed.
Yeah.
And I knew that I couldn't say no, so I instantly said yes. Mm-hmm. And I spent the next week leading up to the retreat planning how I was going to keep everybody at bay. And the thought process in my mind was, I did 10 years in prison. I can do 2 days with these idiots.
And, I don't think most people don't like get all excited about going to a retreat, but once you get there,
It was definitely, you know, I walked in, I had my friends, my brothers, if you will, from this retreat still laugh about me walking in there. I walked in there, I had a hood sweatshirt on, I had the hood on, right? And I was doing the Heisman. So I had my hand out when they were trying to come up to me and hug me and shake my hand. Yeah. I was like, yo, back up, buddy.
Don't come near me.
Step back. And over the course of the weekend, what happened was God revealed himself to me. And what I realized in the process of that weekend was that God is not resentful. He's not angry with me, right? He's just waiting for me to peek in his direction so he can get his arms around me again, right? And that happened that weekend. That happened in a way that, even more profound than my first conversion. It really, I got knocked to my knees. And when I tell you that I wept for days, I went home and I was busted up. I was really busted up. And I didn't have the excuse of I didn't know better, because I did know better. Mm-hmm. And I chose to walk away from him. And that was 15, 16 years ago. And since that time, a lot has transpired. And in my life is, I continue to chase Jesus. I continue to try to share my experience and my conversion with as many people as will listen to it. And, I did the Divine Mercy Chaplet on Instagram Live with a priest from the Divine Mercy Shrine in Stockbridge, Massachusetts the other day. And we did the chaplet, and then I shared a little bit. And the father said to me, he said, it's interesting that as many times as I've heard you tell this story or variations of this story, and as many times as you had, you still get emotional in certain places. And I'm curious, why is that? And it's, for me, sharing my life, sharing my testimony is not about me. It's about what is possible with God, right? And when I think about the mercy and the grace that has been poured out over me, it's so overwhelming, right? Not because of me, but because of him, that he chose to love me in spite of all that I just shared with you.
The untold story continues right after this. It's interesting. I just think that some things will always be emotional when you hit them in a story. You know, when, for me, listening to this story the second time, when you talk about your mom's letter, it just blows me away. I guess as a mom, and I have two sons, you know, how, even though she was a serious, tough love advocate, which you demonstrate, it's, I can't even imagine the intense relief and gratefulness and love that she felt when she saw that you were going to be okay. I can't even imagine it, because I'm sure for you, for her, you were just dying over and over. And she was suffering, I'm sure, so deeply. I know you lost her a few years ago. I lost my mom at the same age. Your mom was 78. So was mine. So, and the older you get, the younger that seems. So she's missed a lot of your kids and your family life and all of that. I know that, you know, from my own experience too. But it also makes me think of Larry Kudlow, who you may know, who's on our air a lot. And he's an economist, and he has a very powerful conversion story as well. And he was into alcohol and drugs and, you know, go-go 80s, worked on Wall Street and just, you know, got really deeply addicted. And but one of the most, one of the things that always gets me when I listen to his story is he talks about going to church and on Holy Thursday, and he said the priest was washing everyone's feet, and he just couldn't take it. He's like, I just started crying and I couldn't stop crying, because he knew that he felt that incredible grace that he had been saved, and he was so grateful for it. So I just think your story is so powerful, Jim. I know, you know, with your kids, so it sounds like your children brought you back. They saw that you had drifted. And it's interesting because I think we all, as Catholics or as people of faith, you know, you kind of drift away sometimes, and then you find something or something happens, it pulls you back. And so the more I was, you know, always Catholic, but not particularly devout. I didn't really have a great understanding of my faith until the last several years, actually, when I started studying it and reading more and, you know, doing it in a more personal way. But now when I pray that God will, like, just keep me close, like pull me in, you know, just keep me near you, because I drift away and other stuff becomes more important. And that's what I pray for my family. You know, not like make sure nothing bad happens to them, not make sure, you know, because bad things happen. And but I always just pray that he will keep pulling them in, you know, and keeping them close. And so that's why I'm sure I annoy my children sending them, you know, little text messages that, you know, you should listen to this on Hallow. But that's what I'm really doing. I'm just trying to stick it in front of them so that maybe they'll listen and maybe they might be drifting and maybe that'll pull them closer. So I'm grateful to you for, you know, sharing your story and keep sharing it everywhere you can. You know, it's very powerful, and I think something that a lot of people can relate to.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, God has been very, very good to me. And if I can just leave people with one message and one belief, is that nothing is too big for God. There's nothing that you can bring to the foot of the cross that is too big for him, that he can't handle. You know, Christ is... He just loves us so much, and he's just waiting for us to approach him. I know, though, there's a lot going on in the world, and I have three beautiful children. All, you know, my daughter is a true woman of God. No question. My boys are caught up in the world a little bit, and you know, and that happens, but they have a foundation, and they have examples of what it is to be faithful people. And we pray that, you know, that everybody finds a way back to the foot of the cross.
Well, thank you, Jim. And keep us posted on, you know, new projects as they come your way. And we're excited to share your story on the Untold Story podcast, and look forward to speaking with you again, I hope.
Martha, can I just tell you about one project before we go?
I have a film coming out,
a Fathom release, Jesus Thirst, The Miracle of the Eucharist. We have a 3-day release, which is kind of unheard of for Fathom, June 4th, 5th, and 6th, on 1,000 screens across the country. And they just added, so not only do we have the 7 p.m. time slot across the country, but we now also have the 4 p.m. time slot so that young people and the elderly can get to the film. So I'd encourage everybody to go see that film.
Tell everyone one more time, Jim, where they can get it, where they can find it, and when, and the name of it.
Yep. So it'll be on 1,000 screens across the country. So more than likely they'll be playing in a theater near you June 4th, 5th, and 6th. And it's called Jesus First, The Miracle of the Eucharist.
It sounds great. You know, one more thing before I let you go, it feels like there's just a lot happening in this space and that people are very open to hearing these stories, watching these movies. You know, I talked about another movie that is about Cabrini, and it feels like...
Yeah, my friends made that movie.
Yeah, I interviewed them the other day. It's a fantastic story. So I feel like there is between, you know, Hallow and The Chosen and all of these really well-done works, the work that you have been doing, the Mother Teresa movie and your book, The Big Hustle... do you think that there is something happening? Is there kind of an awakening or a mainstreaming of acceptance of this kind of work that didn't used to be there? Or is it my imagination?
I think it's the biggest, best thing to come out of COVID.
Yeah.
In my humble opinion, I feel like so many people just were not only afraid, confused, suspicious, a whole bunch of different places, right? But I think so many people turn back to their faith, right? Yeah. Just think about no airplanes in the sky, no cars on the road, right? Everybody's in their home, and everybody's afraid. They don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
And I really feel like it, you know, for me and for my family, it brought us together in a way that we needed to be brought together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I choose to think that there may be been something else behind all of this that wanted us all to just stop for a few minutes and really look at our lives and what really is important. And, you know, and the world is the world, and, you know, and it's almost like that never happened, right? We've moved on from that, right? They're not even trying to slip in the mask anymore. We've moved on. And, but it was an unbelievable time for humanity. And I think that, you know, and then the others are the obvious, right? So when somebody makes a film and it's successful, that gets people excited and they think, oh, I want to do that. I can do that. I have a story of faith that I want to share. And so there's been some really huge projects that have done very, very well. And there's an endless amount of stories to be told, for sure.
Yeah, there certainly are. Thank you, Jim. It's really a pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to talking to you again. And best of luck with the new project. And keep us posted, and we'll push it out on social media and do what we can to make sure that people are aware of it. So thank you. Thank you very much.
I appreciate you.
All right, you too,
Take
Jim.
Care.
Take
God
care.
Bless you.
God bless you as well. Thank you, my friend. Jim Wahlberg. The book is called The Big Hustle, A Boston Street Kid's Story of Addiction and Redemption. And we thank him for joining us. He also did a book on a movie on Mother Teresa called No Greater Love in 2022, and the new project coming out on Jesus Christ and the Eucharist. So we thank Jim for being with us today. Thank you for joining me for The Untold Story. We'll see you next time. I'm Martha McCallum.
You've been listening to The Untold Story with Martha McCallum. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Make sure to rate and review. For more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcast.com. Listen ad-free with the Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
We'll be right back. I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.